Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's play the game where I say a word and you say the first thing that pops into your head. Humor me. Okay, the first word is smallpox. So, I imagine some of you might have pictured something along the lines of a freshly dug grave, or maybe a scarred face. I am willing to bet most of you came up with something associated with death. And for good reason. The death toll of smallpox, just since the beginning of the 19th century, is enormous. It's about 300 million. Now I have a different word for you. Ready? Measles. Let me guess. Chicken soup. How about a little boy or a girl with a thermometer in their mouth? Well, whatever it is, I'm pretty sure most of you thought of something relatively benign. Because for most of us, measles is just a common childhood illness like mumps or chickenpox. It's a disease so harmless, some parents opt out of the vaccine because they'd rather risk measles than a shot. But here's a factoid which puts measles in another light altogether. As I said, smallpox has killed 300 million since the 1800s. Well, measles has killed 200 million. It's the second deadliest disease in a long list. It comes ahead of the Black Death. It also tops the Spanish influenza, which only took out about 80,000. That's right along with malaria. Measles may seem benign, but its complications are not. Today, we're going to reintroduce you to this overlooked virus. And to do that, we're taking you to Minnesota, the state that had the largest outbreak last year, a year which saw a major uptick in measles cases in the United States. Maximilian is about to get his scheduled immunizations at Children's Hospital of Minnesota.
Okay, are we ready? Are we ready? Okay, Dad, and then we are doing the Hep A and the flu, okay?
You gotta take two shots.
Yeah, one each leg.
You gotta lay down for a minute, and then you can finish playing.
This scene goes on every day at hospitals all over the world. Immunizations are routine.
Well, like
that doesn't make them any more pleasant.
Push down a little more, bud.
Don't look. Look at that.
Okay, bud, real quick poke.
Good job!
It's okay, it's okay, it's okay, one more. It's okay, it's okay, it's okay.
Look at you, you're all done!
Big boy!
Another day, another shot.
Do you want some stickers?
Another sticker.
Okay.
Business as usual at Children's Hospital. But in the spring and summer of 2011, there was nothing usual about the business here at Children's. Back then, this hospital was in crisis.
I'm Patsy Stinchfield. I'm the Director of Infection Prevention and Control, and my job is to make sure that children don't get infections when they come here to Children's.
Minnesota had the largest measles outbreak in the United States in 2011. Like many previous outbreaks in the U.S., the cases were linked to people who traveled abroad. After the first case was diagnosed, the hospital went into immediate emergency response mode.
So being an infectious disease, when you hear measles, what the first thing you think about is how extremely contagious this virus is. It's a very small particle virus. It floats aloft in the air in a room for 2 hours and can infect someone who walks into that room 2 hours later who's not immune.
The virus has staying power, but just how many people can it latch onto?
Say there's 10 people in a waiting room, and none of them have ever had a measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. 9 out of those 10 kids will get measles. That's how contagious it is.
Since parents bring their feverish, undiagnosed kids to hospital clinics, if just one case of measles surfaces, it sets off a whole chain reaction of detective work.
Well, where was this child, and who were they around, and who have they potentially exposed, and what are the exposed people's immunization status? Who was in the waiting room? What was happening in the emergency room? Where did they go? What hallway did they go down? What room did they go in? And we had close to 700 kids that were exposed over this outbreak period that we had to track down, call, look at their immunization status, and some of them asked them to come back in and get immune globulin antibodies to protect them.
Now, you might be thinking, it's just measles. Kids used to get measles all the time before vaccines. What's the big deal?
Olivia, my eldest daughter, caught measles when she was 7 years old. As the illness took its usual course, I can remember reading to her often in bed and not feeling particularly alarmed about it.
Writer Roald Dahl, best known as the author of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, in an open letter to Britain, written in 1986.
Then, one morning, when she was well on the road to recovery, I was sitting on her bed showing her how to fashion little animals out of coloured pipe cleaners, and when it came to her turn to make one herself, I noticed that her fingers and her mind were not working together, and she couldn't do anything. "Are you feeling all right?" I asked her. "I feel all sleepy," she said. In an hour she was unconscious. In 12 hours, she was dead.
Olivia Dahl died of measles encephalitis in 1962, before the vaccine for measles was widely introduced. She was a normal, healthy little girl. This complication of measles still occurs in about 1 in 1,000 cases, and it still kills. Modern medicine has not come up with a foolproof treatment. But there are many lives at stake when it comes to measles.
There.
Just ask this mom. She was one of the parents that Children's Hospital of Minnesota tracked down in 2011 during the outbreak.
My name is Laura Bredesen, and my son Benjamin has acute lymphoblastic leukemia.
In March of that year, Laura brought Ben in to Children's for chemotherapy.
But one of the pieces of his treatment is that he is extremely immune suppressed, so his body doesn't have cells to fight. And then less than a week later, we received a phone call that there had been another child who had been in the same treatment area as Ben, and that child had later come down with measles.
The hospital moved fast.
They said he could have measles. They said, you know, it could be life-threatening. He could get pneumonia. He could get encephalitis. There are a number of things that would not only be a hospitalization, but would be a life-and-death situation for him.
Children's advised Laura to bring Ben in immediately to get immune globulin. Immune globulin raises antibody levels to help people, and especially immune-suppressed people, fight off infections. It's not just one shot, though.
Which was very difficult for all of us to watch, as 4 nurses gave him 1 shot, and then they got the needle in the other hand and gave him the additional 4 shots in his legs. By the end of the night, he wasn't walking because of the pain from the shots.
That was just the beginning of Ben and Laura's ordeal. Since Ben had potentially been exposed to measles, he had to go into quarantine for 3 weeks.
And you're just wondering if one day he's going to wake up with a rash and what that's going to mean. And the doctors did not mince words on how serious this could be for a child like Ben.
That went on for 18 days. And then, 3 days before the end of his quarantine, Ben woke up with a rash.
At that point in time, they said stop giving Ben his chemotherapy because he needs all the help he can get. The chemotherapy decreases his white blood cells or infection germ-fighting cells. And so we were very lucky when after, I don't even remember how many hours, Patsy Stinchfield from Children's Infectious Disease Area called us and let us know at about 8 at night that Ben did not have measles.
What a journey to go through to find out then at the end.
Right. You know, Ben's fighting for his life every day with leukemia. And why should he have to fight something like measles when it's something that people can vaccinate for?
Ben and his family were lucky last year. 9-month-old Mahi Koto was not.
Mahi was our sickest patient.
My name is Nuria Koto, and my son, his name is Mahi.
He had measles virus throughout his lungs, terrible pneumonia. He was on a ventilator for over 15 days, unconscious, paralyzed. Mahi was very close to dying.
All told, Mahi spent about 3 weeks in the hospital. And then he turned a corner.
One day he decided to breathe by his own. I was so happy that day to see him up, waking up. He was crying. I was like, he knows me. Oh, my God. He knows me. Oh, my God. So that was how scary he was.
People think measles is a disease of the past. And they think measles is a itchy rash with a fever. And they tend to minimize it. When you work here at a children's hospital, we see the sickest of the sick. And we know that we can prevent measles. And this is the reason why it's easy to get passionate about this.
Most of us don't remember what measles was like before the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine was introduced in the 60s. In those days, when kids got measles, it spread quickly. The virus is airborne and easily transmitted by a sneeze or a cough. And days before you develop a rash, you can be contagious. That means lots of kids going off to school spreading the virus and more kids bringing the virus home. In an epidemic in 1964, nearly 12.5 million people in the U.S. got the measles. We also don't remember that as many as 1 in 20 children with measles used to get pneumonia each year. Thousands more suffered serious complications like deafness, blindness, and brain damage. And about 400 to 500 people died each year of measles. Today, several generations have now been vaccinated, but there's still people who don't get the measles shots. They can carry the virus into a crowd. And since measles is so contagious, even a few unvaccinated people can cause an outbreak.
Let's picture a classroom. You've got 30 kids in a kindergarten classroom. You need most of those kids, 28, 29 of those 30 kids, to be vaccinated to prevent the spread of measles within that classroom.
This is what's called herd immunity. The more people in a group who are immune, the less likely the virus will be able to jump from one vulnerable person to the next.
If you only have 15 of those 30 kids vaccinated and one of them comes in unvaccinated with measles, that will very easily spread throughout that classroom.
So who's vulnerable? Well, for instance, people who for whatever reason didn't get all of their shots. Or in rare cases, people for whom the vaccine doesn't provide full immunity. And outside the classroom, there are other vulnerable groups. Infants too young to be immunized, or someone whose immune system is compromised, like Ben, or someone who's very old or who has cancer.
And you don't know where those children are who are vulnerable, in the grocery store, at church, at your synagogue. People are vulnerable to this disease are everywhere. And so protecting our own kids and helping protect the whole community is really the right thing to do.
In the United States, the rate of measles has stayed relatively low. There are fewer than 230 cases a year. However, measles is very common in many African, Asian, and European countries. And because of that, U.S. outbreaks are usually linked to foreign travel. Mahi caught measles on a family visit to Africa. Ironically, his mother, Nuria, did take Mahi and her three older children to get the recommended travel shots, including the MMR, the measles vaccine. But then during the visit, she made an impulsive decision.
In the last minute, he was sleeping and I decided not to give it to him.
So she did everything right. She took her whole family to the travel medicine clinic. She got them their international travel vaccines. He was 9 months old, and it was a recommendation to do an early MMR for him, which he wasn't due until he was 12 months old. She went there to get it. And at the last minute, as he was the last kiddo to get their vaccines that day, he's asleep, she's tired, he's tired. And as all moms, we say, you know, I think we'll just pass on that, or let's skip that today. She just made a last-minute decision that she lives to regret.
It's so easy to understand this. You never wake a sleeping dog or a sleeping baby. But Nuria's decision wasn't made in a vacuum.
Yeah, I had all these doubts going on about MMR shots.
What were those doubts?
From community. In a TV, television, too, the kids, they get autism because of MMR shot.
Autism and the MMR. Rumors about a link between autism and the measles shot have been floating around since 1998. That's when a British doctor by the name of Andrew Wakefield first raised questions about the safety of the MMR vaccine in an article in the medical journal Lancet. Lancet has long since retracted the article. British medical officials have revoked Wakefield's medical license, and scores of independent, peer-reviewed scientific studies have failed to find a correlation between the MMR vaccine and autism. But still, they remain linked in some people's minds.
My name is Hodan Hassan, and I have a child with autism, 7-year-old Jennifer.
My name is Abdi Hakim Hassan, and my son, who is autistic, his name is Mustafa Umar.
Hodan Hassan and Abdi Hakim Hassan, no relation by the way, are Somali refugees living in Minneapolis. In their community, 1 in 28 children are enrolled in special education classes for students with autism spectrum disorders. This rate is nearly 3 times as high as the current rate of autism in the U.S. To Somali parents, it feels like an epidemic.
Our middle name used to be autism. Now it became the first name because every single family who live in Minnesota, they know what autism means. And they may point next door saying, oh, they do have two crazy kids up there.
Yeah, the Somalis view autism as a mental health. The crazy child. If I say it in Somali, it would be or the family who has the sick child.
Abdi Hakeen says his son, Mustafa, was normal until he got the MMR vaccine. As he remembers it, his son had a reaction to the shot and almost immediately went into febrile seizures.
After that, he stopped talking. He used to call the names of all his siblings. He used to call my name. He used to call his mommy's name. And he was putting two sentences together by that time, like saying, I need a McDonald's. Can we go outside? I want to go with you to give me my shoes. All that kind of sentences and that kind of phrases he was mastered. But all that kind of language skill, he lost it. And up to now, he's nonverbal. He doesn't talk at all.
Hodan and Abdi Hakeen had the same reaction when their children were diagnosed. Shock and confusion.
Yeah, I couldn't accept Jenny's, my daughter's diagnosis. So then I had to do my own research. And I did Google. And then I found out when I put autism, vaccines come everywhere.
Hodan immediately stopped vaccinating all four of her children and began a crusade against immunization.
I did go to Somali TV, Somali radios, Somali websites. So then I called everybody and I said, oh my goodness, these people, they're liars. Do not immunize your children. They will make it as it's a safe thing to do. But you need to take care of your children. Yeah, I did that kind of advocacy, trying to protect the Somali children here.
Hodan rummages through a wooden bureau in her first floor apartment in Minneapolis.
This is Jenny when she was, I think, 2 years old, when she was around the time when she was diagnosed.
Oh, so cute. Or the look at her braids or pigtails. Great chubby cheeks.
Yeah.
What is this?
This is the Autism One magazine. Jenny, they did feature her on many Autism One Files magazines.
Hodan spent years campaigning against vaccines, but then something happened that made her question everything she believed about the MMR shot. It came after one of the three visits Andrew Wakefield made to Minnesota to warn members of the Somali community about the dangers of vaccination.
Stephen Miles, who is a professor at the University of Minnesota Bioethics Center, was being interviewed about Wakefield's visit to Minnesota. And what he said was that Somali parents are unsophisticated.
Hodan called up Stephen Miles to give him what for.
So he apologized, and after that he said, once and for all, for your child, be open-minded. Try to educate yourself on both sides. And I'm like, okay, so whatever. What, that doesn't hurt anyways.
Stephen Miles sent Hodan some links to research about the MMR vaccine, autism, and Andrew Wakefield's background.
I never on earth heard that he has committed fraud. The other shocking thing that really makes me mad right now when I remember is that his own researcher, his own lab person in the lab told him, what you're saying is not what I'm saying to you. It's not matching up. No. I was really mad, hurt, taken advantage of, and lied to. Really.
That was the turning point for Hodan. She read everything she could find about the MMR vaccine and immunizations, and she decided the research shows the MMR vaccine doesn't cause autism, that there's no link between the two, that the theory has no proof. She decided she had no choice. She had to tell everybody she'd been wrong.
People are like, we don't know what to do. We don't know what to believe. You were coming to us yesterday and saying immunizations cause autism, oh my God, without having any proof. And now you are saying you have all of these, researches out there, and nobody told us.
Hodan felt awful. And then the measles outbreak happened. 6 of the 24 cases were Somali children. They were all unvaccinated.
I was so desperate when that happened, when that measles outbreak happened. I was so desperate to just go out and scream and say, you know, really, we have to unite. We have to, because they so divided, the anti-vaccine movement divided us so deeply into the community that we really, some of us don't even speak to each other.
You know, human beings, sometimes they believe something which is so hard to make them not believe it.
Abdi Hakeen and Hodan are friends, despite their differences of opinion on the vaccination issue. And while Abdi Hakeen still believes the MMR vaccine caused his son's autism, even he has some doubts.
Sometimes I'm confused. When I see my elder son, he's 17, And I got 14 years old girls who've been vaccinated fully, and they don't have no problems, no autism, no any other complications. It makes me a little bit doubt, says, oh, maybe vaccine is not a problem. I don't know, if they get the treatment for the autism, that may change my mind.
When we start the discussion about having a cure or cures for autism, it's kind of like having a discussion on whether or not there's a cure for being hit by a car.
Ginger Taylor is the executive director of the Canary Party, a group closely allied with Generation Rescue and Autism One. Both Generation Rescue and Autism One declined to be interviewed for this program. Taylor's son Chandler has autism. She believes his condition was caused by the vaccine for diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. Taylor argues that parents have no way of assessing the true risks of vaccines. But that's not the only problem.
Public health has largely approached the question of vaccine injury versus the good a vaccine does by looking at how many measles cases we've prevented with the vaccine. So where public health is coming in and saying, look, we really need to keep measles down. Parents are saying, you know what, if my child gets measles, they'll probably be fine, they'll get treatment, they'll stay home, and then we'll move on. That's not true with autism.
The science is so clear that measles, mumps, rubella vaccine does not cause autism.
Infectious disease specialist Patsy Stinchfield.
The vast majority of parents know that. All of the medical professionals know that. And there really is not a debate in healthcare. There's not a debate in medicine about the safety of vaccines and the lack of link between measles, mumps, rubella, and other vaccines and autism. So what we need to do is just make sure that we stay on the right road, which is finding what does cause autism. We all want the safety for our children.
Stinchfield, just like the CDC and the entire medical establishment, readily acknowledges that vaccines are not 100% safe.
Very rarely, exceedingly rarely, you can have an anaphylaxis or a severe allergic reaction that brings you to the emergency room. What you really should be worried about is measles disease. In measles disease, if you get measles, the chances of you having a brain infection or an encephalopathy, measles going into your brain, is about 1 in 1,000 cases. If you're worried about measles, mumps, rubella vaccine causing that, that's about 1 in 1,000,000 chances.
But why? Despite scores of independent international peer-reviewed studies that find no link between the MMR vaccine and autism, why do some people, including even some doctors and scientists, still believe they're linked?
I'm Brooke Fischoff, Howard Hines University professor at Carnegie Mellon University, and I study decision-making.
Decision science is a relatively new discipline. It looks at how people go about assigning risk and how emotion, past experiences, and other factors influence our decision-making. In the case of the link between autism and the MMR shot, parents' experience tells them that the shot and the onset of symptoms seem to happen at the same time. Therefore, they think there must be a causal link. But that's the deceptive part. Childhood vaccines are clustered close together during the toddler years, when autism is usually first detected.
It's perfectly reasonable for people to try to explain important things that happen in their lives. What's difficult is to put that particular event, which may just be a matter of chance, in context. That's a difficult challenge for scientists. We need large samples in order to be able to establish the correlations involved with rare events like autism. If I'm a parent, I don't have the benefit of that large body of evidence.
Where parents get their information plays a role, too.
I may also find myself in a situation where I'm exposed to a biased sample of evidence. That is, I begin to talk to other people who've had similar misfortune. If I want to go beyond the evidence that I see, I need authoritative evidence from experts that I trust.
If there's one thing nearly everyone can agree on in the vaccination debate, it's the issue of trust.
There's really been a breakdown in communication between public health and parents on exactly what's going on here.
Go anywhere parents gather, and you'll run into some people with concerns about vaccines.
Modern medicine has forgotten his words. First do no harm.
I think I would like more testing.
I think it's an individual choice, but it has to be an educated choice. I'm sorry to laugh about that, but I don't know that there would be something that would make me change my mind to decide the vaccines are safe now, because I think there's way too much evidence, and I know that there are alternatives for me to keep my children safe and healthy by other means, homeopathy, herbs, other things.
I raised my daughter without vaccinating her, and I was educated about it.
I know there's the whole, you know, the herd theory, but I think it's every parent's right to not have their child vaccinated.
Because in my own childhood, I had measles. I was treated and I was fine, and I think my immune system is very strong, and I wanted to have that same option for my daughter. Hippocrates said,
don't hurt your patient. So this is our fourth floor of Children's Hospital in St. Paul, our medical surgical floor.
Patsy Stinchfield.
And this was the floor. As you can look left, you see rooms. As far as you can see, you look right, you see rooms. And it goes all the way down this entire floor. Every single room had a child with measles in it.
Stinchfield isn't talking about the 2011 measles outbreak. She's retracing an older and more tragic path.
So I've been at Children's a long time, since 1989, when we had our first measles outbreak. Three young children died here in Minnesota out of the over 400 cases. And I thought that was going to be the last time I saw a measles outbreak, until this year, in 2011, here again, this time in the Somali community. And I thought, no, not again, not hundreds of kids again. And thankfully, it was contained at the low 20s because of our efforts, early diagnosis, lots of vaccination, lots of teaching, and reaching out to communities to try to help stop it.
Lots of diagnosis, lots of vaccination, lots of outreach. That usually works. But consider the big picture. Measles isn't confined to immigrant communities or people with life-threatening illnesses. Recently, two people had measles and went to the Super Bowl. They started an outbreak in Indiana. The Centers for Disease Control are concerned about the London Olympics. Europe is in the midst of the biggest measles outbreak in decades, tens of thousands of cases on the continent. Remember, with measles, the numbers can get really big, really quickly. Although, when it comes down to your child, just one case is all that matters.
Mine is a very smiley boy since he was born.
Nuria Koto,
very happy.
Her son Mahi nearly died of measles in 2011.
And the first time he woke up and he opened his eyes, he was smiling. I'm like lost. I couldn't stop looking at him, especially doing some things and laughing. I don't laugh back because all this thing is in my mind.
It stays with you.
It stays. I can erase it from my mind. It was hard.
Measles, What's at Stake? Airs as part of Soundprint's World of Viruses, produced with support from SEPA, the Science Education Partnership Award Program from the National Center for Research Resources at NIH. In collaboration with NET Radio, the Nebraska Center for Virology, and the University of Nebraska. The editor was Barbara Cullen. Our location engineer was Mark Sanchez. The show was mixed by Jared Weisbrod. Special thanks to John Calver for voiceover work. We have a special website for our World of Viruses collaboration at soundprint.org/virus. Soundprint is audio engineer Jared Weisbrod and executive producer Moira Rankin. I'm Barbara Bogave.